Welcome to Roots and Ruminants, your podcast for creative and innovative use of farm, pasture, and rangeland. We're going back to the basics of raising and grazing livestock, growing your own forage, and practical land use.
Well, welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Roots and Ruminants. I'm Justin Frichte, again with Jared Nock, and we've got a northern guest, a North Dakotan. From Berlin, North Dakota, we have Christoph Just on the podcast this morning. And so we're excited to have Christoph here to talk a lot about his livestock grazing systems, forage plantings that he's done over the years. It's probably been, 4 or 5 years, Christoph, since you've kind of started doing some of these cover crop plantings and different forage practices. And so we thought he'd be an awesome guest to kind of go through some of those practical ideas and talk through what he's done on his farm. And so, Christoph, why don't you go ahead, like we do with all guests, we'll have you introduce yourself, give a history of your farm, but also talk about where you're at right now with your farm, your livestock, and what's going on in Berlin.
Well, yeah, thank you guys for having me. I'm, as Justin said, Christoph Just, or the old uncle used to say, Just Christoph, however you want to look at it. I would have to say I'm pretty intimidated because not exactly sure how I landed here. I didn't know about the Roots and Ruminant podcast until you reached out to me a little while back, and after knowing this was coming up, I've been doing some binge listening to Roots and Ruminants, and
that's our only way to get new listeners. We just pick random people that we know aren't listening, so that they start.
We're up to 45 people listening.
There we go.
Yeah, but you guys do a great job with some high caliber guests. So I don't know how I fit in here. I guess I didn't say no for somehow.
Everybody fits. Doing the stuff. If people are doing it in. That's no 5-star speaking recommendations required to be on our podcast here. We want to talk to the people that are doing the things and understand how it's going. So Christoph, that's how you fit in here, and don't worry, you fit in just fine.
I think you guys talked about it on one of your other podcasts, but I'm a Rudy now, or what do you guys call your fan club?
It's either they don't tell us. I think they mean
Ruminator.
Yeah. They're fan. Yeah, there you go.
No, sorry. My kids make fun of me when I wear this headset. They make fun of me for a lot of stuff, so that's all right. But I just think it is a tool because it can turn a kind of a mundane job like fencing or tractor driving into a learning opportunity. So that's some technology is good.
Yeah.
But anyway, I do farm and ranch here with my lovely wife Kelly and our three kids just north of Berlin, North Dakota. Our oldest two girls are in college, and our youngest son is a freshman at Lemoore High School, and he's become a big help on the farm. Just a little bit of my backstory to give a little perspective. We operate on the farm that I grew up on, but my dad did have to quit farming when I was a sophomore in college. And he had to quit because of, my mother was in very poor health due to MS and confined to a wheelchair. And at the time, financially, things just weren't working either. So it probably at the time I would have preferred to quit college and come home and farm, but it really wasn't an option. So it kind of, I guess, forced me in a way to finish school and figure something else out. Maybe I'm better off for it. I don't know. But anyway, I graduated from NDSU in 97. You guys don't hold that against me. and went to work as a sales agronomist in Hunter, North Dakota for a couple of years. And then, I was able to take a similar job and back home in Lemoore and move back to the farm and start with a few cows. And but the land was rented out at the time. But thankfully, definitely thank my parents. They made some sacrifices to kind of hang on to the farm and the land, and so we eventually did have the opportunity. But I'm saying all this just because I think it gave me a different perspective starting out. I would say it was around 2000. One of my agronomy customers, he had grazed his cows all year on a field of his corn stalks, and then that spring, you no-tilled soybeans into the corn stalks that spring. And this was when, you know, no-till air seeders were just kind of becoming popular, so it was kind of a new thing. But then that fall, he reported that those were his best soybeans, and to me, I always think of that as that's kind of when the light bulb started going off in my head, both in terms of integrating livestock on crop ground and some of the synergisms. But also it was just, to me, I kind of looked at it as an in to start farming myself, because I didn't have a stitch of machinery, but basically thought I did have some land available to rent. And I thought, here we go, I can hire someone to no-till some beans. And it's kind of easy to start no-tilling when you don't have any machinery to do any tillage in the first place. So don't want to ramble on about that too long. So, but anyway, 24 years later, we're still here to talk about it. And we've just kind of grown the cow herd since then and a few acres. And I guess at the moment we got about 260 or so mother cows to calve in May and June here, and my hired man has another 40 or so here with us, and he's really good. He's gotten into a lot of this stuff, so we can bounce ideas off each other and work back and forth. But I guess just don't know how much you guys want to know, just a little bit about the cow herd. Yep. Pretty much, you know, kept my breeding program simple. Like, I've always just sought out F1 Baldy Hereford Angus bred replacement heifers. And then we cross our cows with usually Limousine or Limousine cross bulls. Sometimes, you know, Simmental bulls, or I think there's a lot of different crosses at work, but more or less just trying to take advantage of crossbreeding and take advantage of what's free, being hybrid vigor and heterosis, and try and produce a good crossbred feeder calf. And then we usually wean in early January and then back around the calves till usually early March. And you know, I like the idea of keeping them on the cows as long as possible. And I think keeping them on the cows all winter would definitely be doable. But at this point, excuse me, it's kind of, we're weaning and doing some backgrounding kind of from a marketing standpoint. You know, people like those backgrounded calves. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the livestock side in a nutshell. And then on the cropping side, it's primarily corn and beans, but we've done a little bit of rye, some yellow peas a few years ago, you know, mixed hay. And then we usually try and do not big acreage is, but some small grains type hay, like barley, oats, or spring triticale. And then follow that up with a cover crop mix to graze. And then the ongoing challenge is just to figure out how the livestock enterprise and the cash crop enterprise can complement each other. And I truly believe they can. Sometimes they're at odds with each other because, you know, I'm not an expert in any one area, let alone trying to be an expert in a livestock and a cash grain producer. But I just believe that the two can work together and complement each other.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So your area there in Berlin, so you're south of Jamestown, right?
Yeah, about 50 miles south of Jamestown.
Okay. So that, are your soil conditions excellent for farm ground? Is it irrigated? Is it light ground? What's
the
farm ground like?
I would say it's a really, really a mixture of everything. For the most part, right around Berlin, I would say we have some really good productive soils. We do have, you know, we're in the prairie pothole area here, so there's some really well-drained productive land, and then there's some that the seasonal wetlands are, you know, it's an ongoing, some wetlands aren't always wet, so it's on crop ground, and that's why they're so good for waterfowl, because they're those seasonal shallow breeding type ponds, but obviously challenging to farm. And you know, you get just to the east of me here in the James River Valley, and there's quite a bit of irrigation through there on some sandy soils. But right around Berlin, we have the section that I live on here, we have the Cottonwood Creek that flows through there, and so we have some pretty good drainage. So it's pretty good corn and soybean country, pretty good productive corn and soybean country, if that answers the question.
Yeah, it does. And then your cows, have you got plenty of perennial pasture around there that you're able to graze?
So not really. We have some, but most of my cows or most of my pasture is west of here. I was able to pick up some ground about 10, 11 years ago near Fredonia, North Dakota, and there's a lot more grass out there. It's only about 40 miles west, but it's, you know, definitely picks up in elevation. They call it the Coteau. Lots of wind towers right on the edge of the Coteau there, but so a good chunk of the cows go out there for the summer, and then, you know, just thinking about how to make this whole thing work. If I can bring them back if I can have some quality grazing, you know, with a swath grazing or a cover crop or different things like that, it's a time of the year where the grass is getting short, but yet you're wanting to provide a little higher plane of nutrition for a growing calf. And wean later, leave the calves on the cows, but still have everything, calves grow and the cows able to stay in condition. I guess maybe that's how I can use some of the cropland here in the grass out there.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think that's the perfect fit, really.
I mean, it's a perfect fit, other than they all got to get loaded on
true.
The truck
yeah,
to
yeah,
go out
there.
Yeah,
it's the convenience factor.
It'd be nicer to open a gate and let them out there.
Yeah. But land use wise, you know, I think that's why you're making it work with your crop ground and doing what you can as far as finding the most profitable scenario, but still getting cattle back. I mean, you're probably bringing them home and grazing stocks in the fall through the winter too, right? And
Yeah. Stock grazing is usually always something we try and plan on. This last winter, it got interesting because we had 2 inches of rain that basically turned it, or it's right after Christmas. We had a heck of an ice storm here that kind of encapsulated all the corn stover under about 2 inches of solid ice for a month. But it did melt back off, and they were able to start grazing again. So
they don't like the corn cob sickles quite as much then.
Right.
So tell us about, so you've done some interesting seedings and some experimentation over the year. We were talking right before the podcast started. I think we want to go into some of the other stuff, but I thought it was interesting you brought up some opportunities that you had to do some big experimentation back in 2000 and 2022 both with prevent plant scenarios. Can we dive into that and just talk about, and maybe since we have listeners from, I know Australia, New Zealand, and out of the country, maybe we should explain what prevent plant is, because we throw that around. It's a term that just everybody knows. And I think it's something that if you have farm ground in South Dakota, North Dakota, Minnesota, it's part of your vocabulary all the time. But I think outside of that, it's not that well known. So I'll kind of set the stage here. So in the federally subsidized crop insurance that we have in the United States, there's a opportunity to collect something called prevent plant if the conditions, weather conditions, prevent you from planting the crop in the window that is insurable. It's normally, almost always in our situation, because we're too wet. Although I think like in Western Kansas, East Slope, Colorado, you can take prevent plant for being too dry if there's not enough moisture conditions to start in dry land. So when that happens, you're basically given a percentage of your total insurance guarantee to not farm. And it used to be very restrictive because we used to have a lot of more price controls where we were trying to prevent, basically we were using our kind of system to prop up prices to some degree. So they didn't want you to plant anything out there because it might disrupt other commodity markets, rolling into other crops and things like that. So if you take prevent plant, it used to be very restrictive and you could plant something to hay or graze, but not do anything with it till after November 1st, which in our part of the world, South Dakota, North Dakota, could mean that there's nothing to it, right? Completely snowed in. You can't hay it, can't chop it. I mean, it's usually not functional. They made some changes a few years ago in 2019, 2020, in the middle of the season of prevent plant, and then more recently, permanently, to where you can hay, graze, or chop any forage planted on prevent plant acres at any point in the summer. And the only real restriction on what a forage or a cover crop is that any straight corn or mixes with grain corn in it are not included as a cover crop species. That helps at the stage a little bit.
Yeah, no, I think that was thanks. That was a good description. And there still are some restrictions as far as what you can plant. Like you can't plant corn. Guys know.
It's basically just no corn, I think.
Yeah.
I mean,
which I don't understand that. I mean, why can't you plant corn as a forage when you can plant any other crop as a forage?
The old boys in Wisconsin were planting, just waiting, taking prevent plant, getting a prevent plant corn check, and then planting straight corn and chopping it for silage for their dairy farms like they were going to normally. So it just got abused, to be honest with you.
Which you still could do with sorghum or anything else, I guess.
Not officially endorse roots and remedies strategy to, yes. But yeah. I think it
No, there's things like, there's still details like that are interesting. Yeah. And, you know, I think the whole prevent plant thing, it's like everything else, it's good and bad, and it's still good and bad. Unfortunately, guys that had pretty good proven yields, you know, there's no incentives to self-insure because you get a wet year where you can't plant. You just push the easy button, take the prevent plant check. Whereas it used to be, if there was some acreage that you couldn't plant, you had to go to plan B, you know, you had, and I think it's been one more thing that has kind of pushed livestock off the landscape because you don't need to have livestock to take advantage of those situations.
Totally agree.
So, you know, those programs really have lots of unintended consequences.
They do. Yeah, this is a our opening up these prevent plant acres for grazing and forage is a very soft, small win in the comparative battle for, you know, equal treatment when it comes to farm programs between livestock and grass.
I think you said that exactly right. But nonetheless, it is a win because it is one thing that helps the livestock guy compete a little bit for land. And I suppose you could say the strictly cash crop farmer, he could still go in there and plant a bunch of forage and then sell that forage. So, but you know, a lot of times they don't want to mess with that. So
they don't mess with that. And around here, when that stuff happens, they don't have a lot of leverage either. You know, they're kind of just like, all right, I'll take a little something for that ground or that forage. But you know, if you're a beef cow calf guy and you're grazing, kind of, you know, buying German millet, there was a bunch of those transactions that happened around German millet the last time around here. And I would say that the cow calf guys, the guys looking feed, had quite a bit of leverage because, you know, the crop farmers are like, well, I either got to spray it 3 or 4 times, you know, turn it black, do all this kind of stuff, or someone will take care of that for me and, you know, maybe suck some excess water out because it's extremely wet. You know, why I couldn't plant in the first place and get something off of it. And so most of those guys got treated pretty good.
Yeah. So, yeah, recently, right around Berlin here in particular, we had, 2019, our corn basically was immature. It just didn't dry down. We combined corn, I think, tried combining corn every month of the year, all through the winter. We had a layer of snow. It didn't freeze underneath the snow. We'd go out there, we'd get stuck. The corn was still wet. It was still light test weight. A lot of guys finished up in the spring of 20 combining corn in June or July. But anyway, we had a lot of acres that were available or that were prevent plant acres. But at that time, like you were describing, as far as we knew, we could plant a cover, but we weren't able to hay or graze it until November 1st. So you're kind of, you know, you really didn't want to stick a lot of money into it because of the reasons you said. And not only that, but by November 1st, typically the quality is not nearly as good. So that year one, and Milborn Seeds helped me put something together, you know, listening to guys like Dave Brandt, if you're familiar with him, I think he's passed away now, unfortunately.
Yeah. Yeah.
He had done quite a bit of planting cover crops with a corn planter and singulating seed. And I was able to get across a little more ground with a corn planter than a drill because that was kind of the machine I had. And when you singulate seed, you can really seed some pretty low rates of seed and really get your seed costs down. So that was one year where had you guys helped me put together a seed mix of similar size seeds that would work with, I used a sugar beet disc in the planter. I can't remember what I all had in there, but I think it was sorghum sedan, common vetch, buckwheat. Oh, there's
maybe a radish.
Oh yeah, radishes. Turnips are way too small. They just get sucked through the plate. Mm-hmm. But it was a very economical cover crop mix. And I guess one thing that really stood out to me is, you know, just how much those plants will compensate at those lower rates. You know, you look at the sorghum sedans and stuff, just the amount of tillers that will come off a plant when it has room like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they did open it up that year, and this piece of ground was about 5 miles south of me. But kind of like we were talking, we were able to haul the cows from pasture and deliver them right onto that field and graze them. Then in midsummer, they did open it up. They did open the hay and grazing up. So
so you planted those in 30s? So you planted in
30s? Yeah, that was in 30-inch rows.
Yeah.
And I would say this piece of ground was 3/4 of land, and we divided it into 80-acre sections and kind of gave them 80 acres worth at a time. And that did work pretty well. So I guess that was one situation where prevent plant, all the negative things we could say about it. Mm-hmm. We tried to turn it into an opportunity, and you know, I always want to keep in mind that it's not just about feeding cows. I mean, I'm trying to recognize that the cows can be a tool, and it was a chance to add some diversity into the rotation and hopefully add some biology through the manure and urine and introduce something onto that crop ground that mm-hmm. that it hadn't seen for a while.
I think back to that year, you know, we really needed to have something to graze because we didn't have corn stalks to graze that year.
That
was such a weird
thing,
you know, I mean, yeah, just our fall winter grazing strategy was out the window too. Not just harvested feeds put up. We just didn't have anything to graze that year.
Right.
It, well, and it's hard to describe how unbelievably wet 19 was in South Dakota and 20 was in North Dakota to someone that hasn't lived here. And yeah, you know, there's places that get more rain than us, but not with our lack of elevation change and clay soil profiles and issues with drainage and stuff. Like it's, I don't know, it's hard to describe just how wet it was all the time and how difficult it was just to even get cattle onto dry ground sometimes, where they weren't tearing everything apart to graze.
Right.
There's,
well, that's,
there's some aerial photos that exist out there of what some of those springs look like in the James River Valley, you know, or the Coteau, when it's really wet and those prevent plant. And it looks like almost one continuous floodplain, you know, filled with water from end to end sometimes for days or weeks on an end.
Well, in that fall of 19, for us, it wasn't so much standing water. It was just, there was so little ground that could just physically support any equipment.
Yeah.
It was, mm-hmm. it could have been slightly dry on top, but, you know, you'd never fill a grain cart more than half full, and you'd be going along, and all of a sudden you were buried up to the axle and unloading the cart onto another cart, and yeah, it was interesting.
So you were able to kind of make the best of the situation, right? With a couple different things. So you had some experimentation in 20, 22, history repeats itself somewhat. Same thing happens again. How did you change your strategy? What did you do different the second time around?
Well, 22, you know, this time we knew that things had been opened up. So mm-hmm. that, you know, just the planning process, when we knew that we could hay or graze, you know, whenever it was appropriate, made it so that it was a lot more interested in spending money on that cover crop and treating it like a, you know, applying good, hopefully good agronomy principles to it, because I guess you could call it a little bit of a double dip. You know, we got our prevent plant check, but then we also had those acres mm-hmm. to grow this forage on, and yeah, just like we've talked, there's been a lot of livestock that's left my area over the last 20, 30 years. Mm-hmm. So this was a time where, you know, it felt felt good to have the livestock to be able to take advantage of the situation. So I guess we did several different things. One field we planted Japanese millet on and had a nice crop there that we hayed. I guess question for you guys, I've heard you guys talk about or promote Japanese millet before. It seemed like, and I don't know if I cut it just a little bit late. I think it was just barely starting to head out. But it seems like, and it was probably, you know, 5-6 feet tall. It was a nice crop. But it seems like the palatability is not as good as some other stuff.
Yeah, it's not as good as German millet. I know that. Doesn't have quite the leafiness. It's a little bit more rigid stalk.
Mm-hmm. You know, we did that on some ground. I'm trying to remember. We did some cover crop mixes to graze. Definitely. You know, one thing that I've struggled a little bit with cover crop mixes is just simply weed control. You know, we get some water hemp and different stuff coming in there, and I struggle to not set myself back in terms of weed control with the more diverse cover crop mixes. If it's not a prevent plant field, one of my go-tos, I guess you could say, is I like to start out with a small grain forage, and I definitely like forage barley. Maybe not quite as productive as oats, but it's something that we can cut like the first part of July, and we try and get the hay off as fast as we can, and then immediately follow with a diverse cover crop mix. And then graze that cover crop mix. And then the other thing I like to do is that initial small grain hay, I put that in a row in the middle of the field and put a hot wire around it. And then when I'm grazing the cover crop mix, I can easily reach over that hot wire with the loader tractor, grab those bales, and feed those bales as much as possible. Like I'll divide that field in fourths even, graze a cover crop mix, and then feed the forage barley. So I'm not removing anything from that acre. And I can get some really good head days when you add everything together. And if I can move something like that around in a rotation, I'm adding a lot of diversity. And I'm covering the livestock integration, soil health principle. So I kind of veered off there a little bit, but that's, I would say, one of my go-to practices that I like doing. People talk about a season-long cover crop, but I almost feel like in my neck of the woods, if we don't plant something till June, like a diverse cover crop mix, we're kind of missing a big part of the growing season.
It's tough.
And we need that cool season grass to start out with. And it also gives, I think I kind of went there because I was thinking about weed control. It gives me an opportunity to come in with something pretty cheap, like a, you know, an MCP in that forage barley. Mm-hmm. And wax and broad leaves.
Yeah, that weed control thing is huge. It's a much easier program to control those weeds with a two-step program like you talked about, and it gets you planting early. Always been my biggest hang-up, and I've tried to cheat in South Dakota here by telling guys like, oh, it's fine. These diverse grazing cover crop mixes with sorghum in it. I'm like, you can cheat a little bit. Just go ahead. Just plant it May 1. It'll be fine, right? It'll be fine. And then it's not fine, right? So then the 30% of the sorghum sedan grass that's in the mix, you know, is either stunted or doesn't hardly come up at all because, you know, either got outcompeted or just came up and got froze off or one of the two things. And so then pushing those seedings off till the end of May. And yeah, I mean, I've been a part of like, hey, we want to plant teff grass, supposed to be planting around the 1st of June, ends up being a week later for various things. All of a sudden we're establishing, looking at a stand, trying to see if it made it the 18th of June. I was like, well, the longest day of the year is in 2 days. So the days are already starting to get shorter. Like, I feel like we wasted too much time getting here. So I like the, especially now with spring like this, where you look outside and conditions are fit to plant tomorrow. And it's really hard not to go get something that's going to take advantage of that 45 days.
Yeah.
60 days.
Yep. Do you like feeding the forage barley over the oats?
I would have to say, and they're probably comparable as far as palatability, but I think the, you guys have probably run into this too. I think the problem with these small grain hays is that, you know, sometimes they're a little bit short and we always want to let them go to get a little more production, but they so quickly, when from that boot stage to like the milk stage, there's a very fast transition or progression as far as, you know, like the, I don't know if it's basically the carbon to nitrogen ratio or, you know, they become a lot less palatable really fast.
Yep.
And I think, you know, just go ahead and, especially if you're doing something like forage barley ahead of another cover crop mix, go ahead and give up a little bit of production, because the faster you can get that off of there, you're going to get it back because you're going to have more growing season for the next crop.
Yeah. Yeah. Kristoff, I like how you're really, I mean, with the way you talk about it, it's unclear to me on which is your more important crop here, right? The hay crop that you're putting in, or the grazing cover crop afterwards, where most people it's like, oh, the grazing cover crop is just an add on. If it happens, it happens thing. But where you're saying is like, no, I've got two crops I need to grow. So I need to be very deliberate about the first one to get my second one in. And, you know, an extra 10 days in the middle of summer in Dakotas is a much, much bigger difference. It's a very big difference on what the outcome is come fall. Very big.
Yeah. If you guys don't mind, I'll just run over a swath grazing scenario that I did this past
great
fall, winter.
Yeah.
I didn't know I was going to swath graze this field, you know, starting the season out. But the year started out, I had rye on this particular piece of ground. And we grazed the rye in the spring, used, as you guys know, wonderful place to calve cows out on, or we were kicking new pairs in there. And I wouldn't say our management was great, but we did divide the field in half and tried to rotate back and forth just to keep it vegetative as long as possible and allow a little recovery. But anyway, that, you know, we've done that before and love having a piece of rye for new pairs in the spring. But yeah. Anyway, I wasn't exactly sure what I was going to do with this rye after that. Seed planting soybeans was an option. But anyway, nothing got done, and I terminated the rye. I would say the toward the end of June. And then it was just kind of driving me nuts, because I had a field that was sitting fallow during the longest days of the year and just wasn't taking advantage, didn't have anything going on there, which in high price crop ground just was seeming ridiculous to me. But trying to make a long story short, in I think it was right around the first part of August, I came in and planted Goliath forage oats. And we did have a very nice fall here. We caught some nice fall rains, and in about 60 days we had a heck of a nice oat crop on there. So this stuff got put in a windrow right at the end of September, first part of October. And then I was kind of set up to swath graze this piece, and this was my first go at it. Listening to the different YouTube videos from all the Canadians have done a bunch of this, and they kind of recommended putting as big a swath together as possible. And I think the main reason for that is if it gets buried under 2 feet of snow, it's just easier for the cows to, there's more reward, you know, for digging under that snow. So we did, I cut it with just a regular disc bind, and we rolled four windrows together. So we had like 48 feet of windrow, big windrow. But yeah, we did daily moves on it, and it was my first go at it, and you know, it penciled out good. It was decent quality, good protein, probably more protein than they needed, arguably a little bit short on energy. I probably could have supplemented something there, but I thought everything did pretty well. So one thing I want to say about that fallow period that was bothering me so much. Oh, and when we planted the oats, we used zero fertilizer.
Okay.
But the light bulb started to kind of go off, like, man, how did I raise this good of oats crop with no fertilizer? And I think between grazing the rye and then having that fallow period for some pretty good mineralization to take place in the rye roots to break down and release the nutrients they had sequestered, I was able to come back and raise that second small grain crop. You know, I kind of hit the cool seasons on both end of the year, but I kind of, you know, missed the warm season part. And I don't know if you can do all three. I mean,
yeah.
You guys got any
thoughts on, I won't,
yeah.
You know, I won't break the rules here and say that you're supposed to have a fallow period, because I think that's but it, understanding each individual situation is not the same thing as understanding the ideal. So, you know,
there you go. I like that.
B is that, you know, normally when you plant right into rye, you have this short-term nitrogen deficiency because rye is such a good scavenger at pulling nitrogen out that it's hard for a corn crop or sorghum or millet or anything like that to be. On top of allelopathic effect, I think it's much more about nitrogen. You know, rye is just more aggressive at what nitrogen is in the soil. Well, when it does that, it puts it somewhere, right? And so you didn't take a rye crop off of there, you grazed it, right? And so, like you just said, allowing for that, instead of planting right into the rye right away, where the rye is still competing with it, or it's green, or it's still held up, you actually had your rye basically composting and degrading and releasing the nitrogen back, because it's really good at collecting it and storing it, but it does give it back to other plants at some point. And you might hit that cycle just right, where instead of being nitrogen deficient, like you'd expect to be right after a rye crop, or, you know, a rye forage crop, you didn't have a rye forage crop other than cattle. You had manure out there, and you caught the rye roots right at the right time of decomposing, where they were highly available instead of tied up. Be my theory.
No, I think you're right on. And it's tied up and it's eventually going to release, but
yeah.
We can speed up that process using the livestock.
Yeah. And I would say you might have had the same success, or maybe even more, with a short-term brassica cover crop bridging those two, because that was just going to further speed up the decomposition and the nutrient cycling, you know, from that grass cover crop. Justin, does that make sense?
Yeah, theoretically, that's how it should work. A low-carbon species in that rotation should start to decompose everything else faster.
Yeah.
So I had to give a little presentation the other day on swath grazing. I'm I'm on the North Dakota Grazing Land Coalition and our county soil conservation board. And I'm not a public speaker, but somehow I'm finding myself in these things. But
you do something different. Now you're an expert on it and get to talk about it.
Yeah. Before I talked about swath grazing, I wanted to put something together. Basically, just talk about the fact that it's swath grazing is a way to feed livestock, but it's so much more than that. And one of the things I'm trying to just always keep in mind is basically I like this saying that you know, a cow is a very inefficient animal, but it's this inefficiency that makes ruminants such efficient soil builders. And if we can just always, you know, keep that in mind, and it's actually one of the arguments people use to say that we shouldn't eat beef is that beef cattle are so inefficient. Why don't we just take this production? We could feed a lot more people, but they're kind of taking things out of context or not thinking holistically. When if we can think about how that animal can provide these ecosystem services and contribute back in terms of soil building, you know, it's not a linear equation where you take this feed, you feed it to the animal,
yeah,
and then it's over.
Well,
if we can think of this equation as a cycle, as holistically as a circle, that to me, that's what something like swath grazing can really be about.
Mm-hmm. Jared, do you like to think of grazing livestock as a circular system?
Yeah, about a year ago, I didn't talk on this. Yeah. No, it's I was just kind of chuckling. I had great points, and I was just thinking do that to the next iteration on this whole, you know, cattle aren't as efficient. And when it comes to, you know, high starch diet, this is our academic training, which is like, yep, you know, best you're going to get from a feed to gain conversion and a high starch diet in a feed yard for a steer is, you know, 5-1. Well, pig's going to be 2.5, 3-1, 3-1. Chicken's going to be, you know, 2-1. Fish are like 1-1, darn near. So, you know, farm raised fish. So it's like, we're not going to compete with that. Yet those same species and humans as well. We don't talk about feed to gain ratios in humans, although maybe, I don't know, if the problem gets worse, maybe we start talking about it. But those other species would starve to death on things that cattle could do a 10-1 conversion on, right? So, you know, a black rounder that's getting, you know, 1.5, 2 pounds a day really probably only has a 9-10-1, 8-10-1 dry matter conversion ratio into gain. It doesn't sound very good, except the pigs would die. And the chickens would, you know, not gain any weight. Oh, if there's enough bugs out there, they'd be fine. But on the grass alone, they wouldn't be able to survive. And so it's like efficient compared to what? Because which way you're wanting to run, it's either really fast or too slow at the same, you know, it's just whatever race you want to talk about.
Yeah.
So, same thing with humans. Yeah. Is it efficient to take, you know, technically, you could sit down and eat corn as a human and survive because it's calories. It's called eating Doritos, and it's not healthy, right? To eat 4 bags of Doritos a day as your diet, that's a corn diet. Yeah, you could feed more people Dorito chips than if you took the corn, put it in Doritos, and fed it to people than if you fed it to beef and then fed people. But the problem is the people aren't near as healthy eating 4 bags of Dorito chips a day as it would be. So. It's a short, snappy little comment, you know, that people say, you know, cattle, like you're trying to come back or stuff with your comments, like, well, we're not efficient, but in what?
Right. In what?
That's how you ask
context, like, or
context.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, we're just trying to. One of the other things that I talked about too was something that's underappreciated is we think we I've seen some different studies, but we think we can haul this manure back out, and we know the manure has value as spread manure, but the amount, all the nitrogen is in the urine, and anytime we're feeding in a dry lot, how much of that urine are we hauling back out? Well, I think the nitrogen and the potassium are, 90 some percent of that is in the urine. So something like swath grazing, if that stuff isn't falling right where it can do some good, you're probably losing it. So there, it's that inefficiency that's why cattle can be such a good tool. And I'm not trying to diminish the fact that we still need them to, pull their own weight and but they can really contribute to a cropping system.
I think that goes back to just how you started this conversation with trying to find the balance between your productive crop ground and getting the cattle on there and finding the balance. And you said sometimes it's tricky, right? But in this scenario, we're talking about efficiency of both things, right? You're taking efficiencies from that cropping systems by putting a grazing crop in there and not hauling manure and probably reducing a little bit of your fertility inputs. And so it's just, yeah, we're in what system and in what rotation can you take from the livestock, give to the crop ground, and vice versa. And I think that's the balance of the game.
This is another one of those bigger conversations that sometimes I don't know if I can talk intelligently about or not, but I take these bits and pieces from other presentations and try and learn. One thing that Dwayne Beck always likes to point out is, it's a 5-to-1 ratio. Like, in other words, it takes, 1 gallon of diesel fuel equivalent to produce 5 gallons of nitrogen. So we have all these other factors like crop insurance, and I think another big factor why we've lost so much livestock on the landscape, or why we don't need to have more complex systems, more complex rotations, is basically because we have cheap oil. It takes this massive amount of energy to convert the nitrogen in the air into a product that we can transport and spread and apply. But as long as oil is relatively cheap, it still kind of works to produce that fertilizer instead of cycling it naturally, with livestock.
For nitrogen fertilizer is has this weird artificial subsidy in relationship with oil, where largely, so there is a nitrogen fertilizer that got built in North Dakota here a few years ago, correct? Or we're going mostly because of, or they were trying to because of excess natural gas coming off the Bakken.
Don't think we have
Maybe
one
it didn't happen.
yet.
It was talked about. So most of our nitrogen fertilizer comes from places that have access natural gas, right? It isn't places that just have natural gas, because if there's a more relevant industrial, heating, residential, commercial demand for the natural gas, that takes precedence. So nitrogen fertilizer is largely produced in areas that have a surplus of natural gas because of oil exploration, where they have so much oil, like the Middle East, they have so much oil. Natural gas is a byproduct. You can either flare it or you can pipe it. So when you see flares on oil fields, that's where the natural gas methane production is not equivalent enough to actually pipe in, and you have to get rid of it, through burning it right there. So if oil exploration and drilling goes down in the future because of solar powered vehicles and things like that, things of that nature, or from biofuels, or if we just get much better and do more biofuels instead of regular oil. And I'm not predicting that, but then you lose this kind of natural source of excess natural gas in places where it makes sense to make nitrogen fertilizer with it, because it'd be very different if every state or every even region had to have their own kind of local nitrogen production facility based on the natural gas costs of that area. That price would look a lot different than it does where you can cherry pick these really cheap pockets of long-term natural gas because of oil exploration, and then make your fertilizer and ship it out from there. So I'm just saying it might be one of those things that is Haber-Bosch produced nitrogen going away? No, but we might be living in the last 50 years, 60, 70 years, the apex of efficiency and cheapness of nitrogen fertilizer that we never saw before or after this, just because of those dynamics.
Yeah. And I'm not one to say to promote don't ever use fertilizer, because I definitely do. And I use a fair amount of it. But one thing I think about, we have a lot of fixed costs. I mean, it's hard to do a lot about land prices. It's hard to do a lot about some of our machinery prices. It's hard to do, you know, we have a certain amount of inputs that I can't change a lot, but I do think fertilizer is one area where there's definitely opportunity to bring that cost down if we can figure out better rotations and livestock integration and things like that. And, you know, and then I don't understand this biological component other than the fact that it's real and it's important, and it's kind of the new thing in ag right now is biologicals. But I really like this idea that a cow is nature's perfect composter. I mean, she's kind of the continuum on the land. I mean, her gut is always the right moisture level, always the right temperature. And during the winter or in times of drought, when that biology really slows down, that ruminant animal keeps that biology going. And it's not just analyzing the nutrients and the manure that's coming out the back of the cow. I think more importantly, it's the manure is feeding the biology, and then the biology is feeding the plant, and round and round we go.
Yeah. Yeah.
This was an interesting observation I had a couple of years ago. I had grazed some corn stalks, and when I was done grazing the corn stalks, I spread some manure out of I have a small feedlot. And the next spring, whenever I go out on the cropland in the spring and I kick over a manure pat with my foot, it's usually, you know, just almost like a vertical column of earthworms underneath that cow pad.
Yep.
But where I had spread the manure and there was a clump of spread manure, you kick that over, it didn't have the earthworms underneath it. So it was just kind of one more thing where, you know, that biology was so much more active under what fell directly from the cow versus what had, you know, sat there for a year in a pile.
Yeah.
You know, both, one was composted in the cow's gut and the other one's kind of composted in a pile, but it just absolutely wasn't the same, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. No, I think you're right on. I don't think we talk about that enough, is the value of the livestock from a biological standpoint. You know, I mean, the compost gaining you the, you know, the NPK nutrients that crops need, but losing what's gained if it's hauled out, or, you know, I mean, there's still a huge value of just, you know, and I think when you hear other grazers talk about, you know, the really in-depth pieces of the biology that come from, you know, we're talking urine and manure, but hoof action also stimulating different things, and saliva, and how plants also act differently from being grazed, and how they do different things with their root exudates. And so, I mean, it's just, you know, when we go back to that circular system and how everything's affected differently, I mean, it does come back to that cow being just a very, very important part of that whole grazing system. And it's right. It's, we like this biological sector that we're in with egg right now, because it makes sense to us, but we love the cow and what she does even more. And so it's like, well, how do we replicate that and just put it on a bigger scene and on our cropland too? That's a big challenge.
Well, I kind of like to say, we're just barely starting to understand all of this stuff, but I don't know that we necessarily have to. It's like, you know, if you can apply the principles of soil health, there's so much going on there. There's so many basically positive unintended consequences. Like, we're setting off this chain. A lot of times when we talk about unintended consequences, it's all this negative chain of events. But I think if we can apply these soil health principles, we don't understand it, but we're setting off a positive
chain reaction
of and I'm not going to try and tell you that I understand it all, but it's just what I want to believe it. I believe it.
And it's funny how you say, yeah, we don't understand.
Something's got to fall under the category of faith, right?
Yeah. It's funny how, like, you can say we don't understand. However, we've been doing it for decades, you know? So,
well, and nature's been doing it for eons.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's good. I mean, I think we could carry this and keep on going further. But we're over an hour, and yeah. So this conversation has been fantastic. It did go fast. Yeah, no, I appreciate this conversation. There's so many awesome bits here. Yeah, anything else that you want to hit on that you really thought we should get into before we close it up?
Oh man, I knew I was going to forget all kinds of things. That might be interesting. So I got notes scattered all over in front of me.
I think we hit on a lot of interesting parts there.
Okay, I'm going to leave you with a random squirrel thought, or maybe we're not done, but I'm going to throw in a random squirrel thought here.
Yeah.
So lots of people are working on compost teas, trying to, you know, I don't know if you guys have ever interviewed anyone making compost teas. But like we just talked about earlier, thinking of a cow as a four-legged compost factory, sauerkraut factory, whatever. Is urine not a compost tea? Cow urine? Has anyone ever tried to treat seeds with urine as a compost tea?
So I think it's pretty sterile in its form directly, right? I mean, it wouldn't have the inoculated biology that you're looking for, right?
I don't know.
I guess.
That's just a ridiculous to think of it.
I think it's highly available fertilizer, right? I know that. And so that might be, I have to like dispel this thought of, you know, we're just getting the seed treater fired up at Dakota Vision Ag here. And I just had this thoughts in my head of like vats of urine, like hauling back, putting it through the tumble treater and then having that get caked on itself for a month and a half.
We're just going to spray it on, you know, just so it dries on and the seed still flows and everything.
We went to vats of urine in our warehouse that we have to run through. So I'm going to get rid of that thought to get back to
you. I don't know how you collect it either, but.
You just have a little stick, a little, you know, little collection deal on the end of it, and you walk around you with your cows a lot. And
big bucket diapers.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. So it's interesting how we pay attention to things that we can buy in a pretty package, right? And so, you know, there's a lot of people talking about biology and biostimulants right now because it's a product that they can buy.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So,
well, I forget which guest you guys had, but I thought it was great. One of you guys, you were talking about the geese and like, what if we put geese, what if we decoy geese, you know, to go feed on the neighbors, you know, and I know we don't want them here when our crop is emerging because they'll clean it off, but
the white ones,
there's certain times where if there's a, you know, a goose on every square foot, they have to be.
Yeah. Yeah. You want
adding lots of fertility.
Well, that I would have a much better confidence that that's adding biology better than putting something with 1034 or start fertilizer. Like I, right. It's gotta be more like that's surviving and working than putting something in furrow, to be real honest. But I don't know. Sometimes it's just like you talked about too, with the faith thing, you know, really, when you get into faith, faith is not believing something that's unbelievable. It's allowing yourself to understand things well enough that you don't need to know everything, but it instinctively makes sense. And this is like, you know, is getting too deep, but this is where people get caught when they get into a, you know, it's going way too deep, like into a cult. They end up believing things that don't make sense, that are untrue and not natural, not normal, whatever. So if you get down that path, then you're in, you know, that's the wrong kind of faith. You're believing things that you shouldn't believe, but it's easier to have faith in things that just make sense. It, like from what we know about history and interactions and things like that. So that's where I go. If it makes sense, it's a lot easier to say, I don't understand exactly how this works, but it does make sense. Of a whole,
yeah.
Right? Back to your comment about believing in the system or where to take directionally, which way to move.
Well, and we're believing in a system that's been here for millennia. Yeah. We're believing in we're just trying to learn some lessons from natural systems that have always been here and built the topsoil that we're farming now. It's
mic drop.
There you go. Christoph, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, it's been awesome. I really appreciate the time. All right, thanks to all our listeners for once again listening, tuning in. Make sure you like us, share it, and we'll get you again in a couple weeks with another episode. We'll see you.
Thanks.
Well, we hope you enjoyed another episode of the Roots and Ruminants podcast. Let us know what you thought of it. You can follow us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, all those social media things. And, you know, if you ever have any questions, just give us a call. We've got a toll-free number here at 888-498-7333. Be glad to hear from you. Thank you.